Hi, I'm Claire Wright.
And I'm Eve Rees.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians, and other victims of the research bug.
We're going to ask these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating, and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, we're talking to Jock Sorong, an award-winning novelist and former lawyer who lives on Victoria's Surf Coast. Jock's first novel, Quota, won the 2015 Ned Kelly Award for Best First Fiction, and On the Java Ridge won the 2018 Colin Roderick Award. For his most recent novel, Preservation, Jock took a deep dive into the archives of colonial Australia. Published in 2018, Preservation is a gripping historical novel based on the extraordinary true story of a shipwreck in Bass Strait. After the Sydney Cove was wrecked in 1797, a group of surviving passengers walked around 700 kilometres up the coastline of southeastern Australia towards Sydney, which made them some of the first settlers to have sustained contact with Aboriginal people. In his novel, Jock tells the story of their epic journey, using a mix of research and imagination to bring this remarkable history to life. Jock, welcome to Archive Fever, or Archives Anonymous, as we like to call it. Now, Preservation is your first historical novel, but was this the beginning of you getting into research, or did you already have the research bug?
Well, I suppose there's an amount of research that you're doing all the time as a lawyer, and I had that behind me over many years. When I went to law school, I remember rolling up to whatever registry it was to sign the papers to start a degree, knowing nothing about law or indeed about universities. And there was a lady behind the counter who threw a handbook at me and said, "You need an art subject." I think the thing fell open at A and I grabbed archaeology. Looking back at that, and bearing in mind this is the early 90s, there was a lot of disappointment in the fact that what you were doing was, it was Mesopotamia, it was ancient Greece, it was the Phoenicians, it was anything but the Australian continent. And I think I imagined then that there must have been some kind of archive that related to here, but it just wasn't accessible at the time.
And did you ever consider pursuing your sort of interest in archaeology further, or did law, was it just too seductive?
Well, it wasn't so much that it was seductive as it was all-consuming. Mm-hmm. There really wasn't a lot of room for anything else at the time. In the last year, I've read Billy Griffith's Deep Time Dreaming, and I sort of saw the whole thing that I had imagined must have been there, which was all of these great stories of persistence and adventure and revolutionary thinking about Australian history. So I feel like there are some lost years in between the two.
Jock, when I was an undergrad student, I actually used to hang out at the law library. I started a law degree and I didn't do more than the first year of it, but I still used to hang out in the law library because there was something about the tomes, the books, the journals, the what do they call the law reviews that were all around me that I found very peaceful and inspiring in some kind of way, or maybe it was just easier to get a seat in there. How were you taught as a law student to research?
It's funny, the first thing I should say in response to that is that I remember the law students used to hang out in the medical library because there were body parts floating in jars of preservative.
Maybe it's just like women who have straight hair want curly hair.
The grass is always greener.
Yeah. How were you taught to research? You were taught to dispense with all subjectivity was the first thing, that everything built incrementally upon itself in the common law, and that in order to understand a concept, you had to understand all of its antecedents going back sometimes centuries, and that there was no room to go off on a frolic intellectually, that in order to make any assertion, you had to be able to show where that assertion had been proven in the past. And that's the idea behind the kilometres of calfskin-bound books, is that somewhere among them, you're able to trace that idea back to its origin.
And was that an intellectual pursuit that turned you on?
I don't think so. That's a really difficult question. I think over a period of years, it becomes second nature. And I think it's a thing that has crept into the way I approach writing fiction, that any assertion, any proposition has got to have some kind of firm ground under it. And that's both a good thing, I think, and it's a good thing in writing historical fiction. And it's also something of an impediment that you're not so good at just letting the wheels spin because you're always looking for this basis.
So it's more like the search for evidence that is going to support a claim that you are already making or that you've already got in mind, rather than necessarily diving into the archives and listening to what the archives have to tell you and creating a story out of that.
Well, I think that's where, for me, there's been a real departure in writing preservation, was that I started to spend a lot more time in archives of various sorts, and rather than going to them for evidence for the proposition I was making, I found myself wandering around and discovering things and bringing them back and asking how I could use them creatively. It's often an interesting exchange in the editing process where you've brought something back because it fascinated you and not because it served the story. And you have these discussions about, well, really, why is this thing in here? And hopefully, by the time a novel like Preservation is edited over many months, the idea of whether the evidence is serving the story or the story is supported by the evidence is smoothed out enough that it's very hard to see the sticky tape and the strings.
Can you give us an example of what happens in that editing process?
Yeah, so I will hand over a manuscript in which there are all these bizarre little artifacts that I've found, and I know which ones were just me nerding out and which ones actually are necessary to the story. And Mandy Brett, my editor, our editor, will write in the margin, how does this serve the story? It's always that particular phrase, and it's a matter of rigor, isn't it? How does this serve the story? And sometimes you can warp the arc of the story so that the thing does serve the story. And sometimes you literally can't justify it and it comes
out. Give me an actual example.
Yeah, okay. Preservation talks a lot about Lascars, Southeast Asian sailors who were used particularly by the British but by a number of naval merchant powers as kind of the human engine. And they were paid badly, they were treated badly. They came from all sorts of nationalities and cultures. And they are a subculture of their own within the telling of all of these seafaring stories. And really, it's very surprising how little is written about them. And I went back and looked at a lot of contemporary stuff about Calcutta as a merchant port. I found this marvellous little anecdote about the way that water was brought onto sailing ships, which was that teams and teams of Indian men, particularly of the untouchable caste, would march down to the dock with animal skins on their backs, sort of worn like backpacks, and the hooves and the neck would be stitched up so that they held water like a bladder. And all of these men would run in lines down to the dock to decant this water into casks on the vessels. And I just thought it was the most amazing visual idea of these running teams of men in the heat with water sloshing everywhere and these bizarre sort of semi-inflated animal shapes on their backs. There was no reason for me to go explaining how the water got onto the Sydney Cove, but here was this great little nugget that I just had to use.
That made it into the finished book, didn't it? Because I remember reading that section.
It did, but there was a terribly childish exchange along the lines of Mandy wrote, "How does this serve the story?" And I wrote, "But I really like it." And she said, "Okay, if you do A, B and C, I'll let you keep your water carriers." And so I went off and did A, B and C elsewhere in the edit. And then there was a petulant little line from me that said something like, "Can I have my water carriers back now?" And I think Mandy's response might have been that because I'd been good, I could have my water carriers.
You've been a good boy.
Yeah.
Well, in my view, I think that anecdote does serve the story because it does create a really evocative sense of what that kind of seafaring life in Calcutta was like.
Yes, and I suppose that exercise of going into the archive and searching for the kind of serious supportive material is often going to take you in these bizarre little directions and give you bursts of colour that you weren't otherwise going to find.
Mm. So let's maybe take a step back and talk about, you know, what archives were you actually using to research this book, and how did you even first find out about the story of the Sydney Cove, and why did you decide to turn it into a novel?
Yeah, okay. Well, I think the first thing to say about that is that although I have some history in legal research, I'm not professionally a researcher. I'm certainly not a historian. So I'm approaching that piece of history very much as an amateur. So there's a sense of sort of hunting around and improvising as you go in that. The two primary sources that I had to work with, and this is one of the fascinations of this shipwreck story, is that there's extremely little in the way of primary source material. There is really a diary which was kept by one of the survivors, which was then lost, but reappeared in a Calcutta newspaper as a sort of paraphrasing or a retelling by a journalist. So we don't know to what extent it's the truth or it's been embellished or there's been various sins hidden in there. And then there's the shipwreck itself. The shipwreck was found in 1977. It provides the most objective material about the story because the artifacts that have been brought up from the bottom just don't lie. You can attempt to superimpose explanations on them, but ultimately those pieces of physical material can't lie to you. So I've got a shipwreck and I've got a fairly questionable diary to work with. Beyond that, it's all secondary sources. So I looked for what I thought were really good colonial histories to talk about Sydney and to talk about the coast. The one that was sort of my lodestar that I kept going back to was Grace Karskens's book, The Colony. But then I had Dark Emu, the Bruce Pascoe book, to look at other ways of telling the Aboriginal side of the story. And that was really important to me. And I think I shouldn't presuppose to speak for him, but I think Bruce Pascoe would say what he wrote was not new material, that it was always there. It's just that everybody was looking in the wrong places. Grace Karskens was a big influence in talking about Sydney. I don't know if a purist would say that using those secondary sources is a good idea when you're writing historical fiction, but for me, I felt a lot of trust in those people as authors. Bill Gammage is another, Tom Griffiths, Paul Irish. There were a number of those books that I think came out within about a 10-year period that gave really new insights into ways that you could talk about the settler era.
One other potential archive that you could perhaps have drawn upon for this book is the landscape itself, because one of the things I found most powerful about the novel is the really, really detailed, evocative descriptions of the changing landscape and the changing Aboriginal peoples, the different groups the survivors of the shipwreck met with as they went on this epic trek. So did you visit this landscape yourself? Did you reenact the trek? And did you speak to local Aboriginal groups?
I did each of those things, but again, I think I should start by saying that I'm not a bushwalking nut. My experience of bushwalking is getting from a car park to a wave, so I don't do it as a pastime in its own right. I did drive out into the various national parks and walk a lot, take photographs and make notes and think about the landscape. And to me, it's a very, very important part of the storytelling in the novel because that landscape is really enigmatic. You go from where the shipwreck occurred, which is granite boulders, arid, windswept landscape, into enormous eucalypt forest in southern New South Wales and a lot of transitional environments in between. And the other thing to think about is that the landscape at that point in time is so different to the landscape now. So the whole time that you're doing it, you're trying to project yourself backwards 220 years and imagine, did this river mouse look this way? Were these birds and plants and other animals here or not here? And that's a really enigmatic process. You feel like you can get a handle on it, then you come around a corner and there's an oil refinery. I did things like walking on a beach near Wollongong, I remember, and thinking about how the sand stuck to your feet because I wanted to know whether it was big, grainy, gravelly sand or whether it was fine, powdery sand, and how would people's footfalls on the beach sound? Would they squeak? You can do a lot of that sort of nutting out. But one of the things that really struck me was I did a particular walk near Eden in the Ben Boyd National Park. And the thing that struck me was the absolute destruction of the Easter weekend, that everywhere I went, it was litter and human remains and tyre marks and churned up paths and churned up beaches and bait packets and, you know, I could go on and on. But the task of trying to imagine this early environment is made that much harder by the kind of rampage of holidaymakers.
That's, of course, one of the great, I think, challenges of writing historical fiction, that, you know, we can visit places, we can undergo similar experiences, but there's a danger of superimposing our kind of contemporary experience of the landscape or our contemporary emotions onto the past. I remember when Kate Grenville wrote The Secret River, she talked about going on the Sydney ferry during a storm to understand the terror of being involved in a storm on a kind of colonial ship, but then she was criticised. Historians said these were not comparable experiences. So were you worried about kind of writing your own subjectivity into the past?
Yeah, very much so. And in fact, I'm building a PhD around the novel, and the whole focus of the PhD is the notion that it's impossible to let go of that subjectivity, no matter how much you try. You know, I think it's reasonable to say that while I might be fascinated with the birds in the trees on that walk, the people doing the walk at the time were looking at their feet. Other than perhaps for edibility, they wouldn't have been remotely interested in the critters, but that's the thing that fascinates me the most. And how do I depict a landscape for a reader without thinking about what's flowering and what's not flowering and what can be eaten and what tastes bitter or is poisonous and which creatures were there at the time and now aren't, or conversely, which creatures have now turned up? I need to paint that picture for a reader. But on the other hand, putting yourself in the shoes, or in fact no shoes at all, of the walkers, those are not things that concern them. There's an artificial process taking place anyway.
Mm. And do we know those things don't concern them?
Well, I don't think we do. What I tried to do was to depict varying degrees of concern. So Srinivas, who's a 14-year-old Indian boy, is very, very observant. And I think very often you can use children in fiction to do the observing, because I think children see the world, well, obviously, with different eyes, and they are much more likely to be mesmerised by a thing of beauty than a busy adult. So Srinivas is there in this book as the observer and a conduit for me to talk to the reader about the natural environment. William Clark is a merchant. His reputation is on the line because the shipwreck represents a huge stuff up for him. He's nowhere near as interested. And then Fig's straight up evil. And
he is very sinister.
I think, again, he's looking at the world with different eyes. So I can use him as a different kind of conduit.
Jock, you've said you only had two archival sources for this book, the shipwreck itself and the diary, or what remained of the diary in its new form in publication. But you clearly had a lot of questions that you had to work through in order to get a narrative structure and the content for it. Here on Archive Fever, we so often talk to researchers who say they just don't know where to stop with their research. They're like a child in a lolly shop. But did you have a kind of archive envy rather than archive fever? Did you wish that you had more substantial sources to base your research on, like when you were a lawyer and you had hard evidence to go on?
No, I didn't, because I think when you're writing fiction, you want enough to be teased into a story, but not enough that there's fights over the truth. I'm interested in what I can plausibly convey to a reader and they will accept without having that jarring feeling that we've all felt when you're reading a book and you think, hang on, is that possible? I want to avoid those little reactions. I just want enough evidence to give me a superstructure under the story I'm telling. So I guess I write everything with the idea that 2% of the populace are going to know something about this in a specialist way that I don't know, and they're going to be scoffing. And if I spend my whole time writing to the 2%, I'm going to go mad and I'm going to tell a really dull story. What you aim for is somewhere below the 2% line where you're just writing a convincing story without necessarily writing a true story.
One of the things that is so strong about your writing as a storyteller is the characters that you develop. Do you feel like your own experience as a criminal lawyer created, in a way, an archive of its own about human character, human motivation?
Yeah, very much so. And the thing about looking back at a legal practice is that you can't mine it for stories because of the various ethics around that. But what you can do is mine it for human reactions. And that's the part that I hope I've carried over from that former career, is the feeling of watching people experience trauma and retell trauma. The ways in which their body and their speech and even their handwriting and their gestures and everything will come to reflect the pain they're going through. That's a very, very useful thing to have seen. It's a distressing thing to have seen, but in terms of storytelling, I think it gives you a sense of realism.
You mentioned earlier that there's, you know, always going to be this 2% of people who will be experts and might scoff at what you've written. I mean, with the case of this novel Preservation, those 2% might be academic or professional historians. Were you at all concerned about what they would say about the novel, especially given the history of people like Kate Grenville writing other historical novels about colonial Australia getting criticised? Was that kind of playing in your mind at all?
Yeah, it was. I think at a base level, I write to entertain myself and then I hope it entertains someone else. But because of exactly what you said, I had a conversation with Kate Grenville early on in the planning of the novel. I'd read Tom Griffith's book, The Art of Time Travel, where he devotes a chapter to the reaction to The Secret River and the way that Kate worked through that. And, you know, I'm an enormous admirer of Kate's intellect and of her writing. And I thought if somebody of that stature has hit a wall in the way that she did, then I'm in for real trouble. But perhaps A, that overrates the importance of what I'm doing, and B, the answer is to tell the story you want to tell and then deal with the fallout. What worried me a lot more than any academic reaction was the Aboriginal reaction, that I didn't want to make presumptions, I didn't want to overstep. I felt that it was vital to tell an Aboriginal story in telling this shipwreck story because the reactions, particularly of the Yuin, to these survivors are so fundamental to why it's an amazing tale that I wanted to get that exactly right and yet not to overreach.
And what has the Aboriginal reaction been like? Has it been positive?
Well, the people I consulted with were really positive, and that was one of the great joys of writing the book, was that I went in with, you know, what was a pretty defensive mindset, and I consulted everybody that I could find, and I provided copies of the manuscript, and I marked up the passages that worried me, and what I got back was not just a dry process of approval or disapproval, but all of these suggestions and wonderful ideas and a lot of humour. If you compare, for instance, in that landscape there were marked trees called dendroglyphs. If you compare the fate of the dendroglyphs, they were marked at or before settlement or around that period, and most of them are gone, either through natural means or through vandalism or development or whatever else, they're gone. And yet the oral history of the survivors walking through Aboriginal country is alive and well, and really 220 years is a very, very short interval when you're talking about an oral storytelling tradition. That was a fascinating thing to encounter. And that entire side of the story is not remotely mine to tell as an author, but it's out there and it's alive. And that was just a delightful thing to discover.
Did you have more anxiety about the reception of this book, Jock, than you have to previous novels? Were you concerned, say, after Quota came out, what people in the fishing industry would think? Or after The Rules of Backyard Cricket came out, what people in the sporting community would think? Or is this a particular, because you're wading into academic turf, did you have a particular set of apprehensions?
I seem to manage to find apprehensions for myself no matter what I do. But with Quota, I think when you put out a debut novel, you're pretty happy if anyone reacts in any way. And Quota was a fairly thinly veiled fable wound around the little town that I live in. So I guess I worried about how the locals would react, but the locals were wonderful. There was a lot of speculating. There was a lot of, I reckon I know who that is. Nobody was right. I'll go on the record as saying that. I didn't worry too much with Backyard Cricket because it was very clearly a made-up tale. And if people chose to apply those characters to actual sporting celebrities, then they were probably miles off the mark. Java Ridge, I was wrong-footed because I wrote a story about asylum seekers and it was, broadly speaking, an appeal for compassion. And I felt like the left would embrace that and the right would ridicule it. And in fact, it didn't go like that at all. It was reviewed on its own terms as a book, which is something I'm grateful for. If you release a book that deliberately prods people, then you need to expect the discussion about that to be pretty robust. So I'm comfortable that that's the case. And really, the minute it's in the marketplace, you're no longer the architect of that discussion. It takes off on its own terms. Here, yes, I think there was that nervousness. Serious people have studied this story in serious ways, and I'm not one of them. I'm simply somebody who was captivated by the profound gaps in the story. You know, that's exactly the thing you want in fiction. I guess the reassurance that I took was, provided that I keep just writing into those gaps and imagining the missing bits, then you're not really set up for criticism about the bits that are documented.
So have you been bitten by the history bug?
I reckon I have. I'm going back to the well, if that's any indication.
So what is the next project?
Well, I have this theory that there's a period of 50 years where Bass Strait was really central to colonial history. In 1797, there's the wreck of the Sydney Cove. When the survivors get to Sydney, they explain that they think they've found Bass Strait. Governor Hunter immediately dispatches Flinders to go and investigate, and within a very short time, he's found and charted Bass Strait, which gave shipping a new way to come into New South Wales. They found seals, and there was a lot of interest in that because seal products at the time were a very, very valuable commodity. And they found coal on the walk as well. So the news of those things sort of spawned these new industries. And within a few years, sealing had become an enormous industry, to the point that some of the species of seals in Bass Strait were driven to local extinction within a very, very short time. During those ensuing years, George Augustus Robinson turns up as a response to massacres and frontier conflict in Tasmania with this kind of missionary zeal and says, I can save the Tasmanian Aborigines, give them to me. And he heads off with a couple of hundred Tasmanians into Bass Strait, trying to set up a colony where he will Christianise and Europeanise Tasmanian Aborigines. That, of course, ends in disaster. And by 1847, his colony called Wibelina on Flinders Island has been closed down with a terrible death toll attached. So between 1797, when the Sydney Cove spuds in, and then 1847, when Wibelina is closed, there's that 50-year period where all sorts of ramifications have rippled out of these uninhabited or semi-inhabited granite islands in Bass Strait. I just think it's a remarkably compact and productive period in modern Australian history. So I want to look more into that 50-year period and see what other stories I can find in there.
So what sort of archives are you heading into this time round?
Well, there's a wonderful museum on Flinders Island. So I've been in there burrowing away a fair bit. I've been out on those islands in boats and in planes, looking at distances. And I use Google Earth a lot for this sort of work because the islands are such a complex environment geographically that it's very, very helpful to try to understand it from above, and also marine charts, because one of the really interesting features of that archipelago, of the Furneaux group, is that the tidal flow through it is enormous. All of Bass Strait empties into the Southern Ocean and the Tasman Sea twice a day through very narrow gaps. So the tides that go through those gaps are quite challenging for shipping. So I've looked at marine charts and thought about, you know, how would a boat behave in these circumstances? There are a few personal accounts of early settlers. There's some very good histories written. There's one that came out just recently called Me Write Myself about Aboriginal history in northern Tasmania and Bass Strait.
Leonie Stevens, the author of that, did her PhD in the history department at La Trobe University.
Ah, there you go.
And taught at La Trobe last year, yes.
And delightfully, the general store in Whitemark on Flinders Island has a really, really good collection of Bass Strait history that's always on the front counter, and I think I've emptied out every single volume they've put up.
As a novelist, you probably approach the archive with a whole range of different questions than a historian might, but it also just strikes me in you talking about the ocean that you're a surfer as well, Jock. Do you think that influences the way that you not only approach story but approach documentary evidence?
Yeah, and I often think too that when you read accounts of shipwrecks, there's often tremendously dramatic language used to describe the conditions, but within a fairly small margin, those sea conditions must have been the same sea conditions we see day in, day out right now. So I wonder to myself, you know, the day that this happened, was it a northerly? Was it a big swell or a small swell? Was it a low tide or a high tide? It's not a different sea. It's just a different way subjectively of experiencing it.
So, unlike the beach that's littered with wrappers from fish bait and McDonald's cups.
Yes, the phenomena are different here in that they are more universal and timeless, whereas the inshore environment we can certainly alter day to day.
Well, and I wonder if even in a bigger sense, being a surfer makes you attuned to the importance of the ocean in history. It struck me that even as you were talking about your theory about Bass Strait being really core to Australian history, I mean, that's a very kind of ocean, water-centred view of Australian history. Do you think your kind of regular immersion in the water helps you kind of think in those terms?
I've never thought about it that way. I suppose it does. I always think a lot of Australian myth-making is terribly focused on the inland and that we're only now beginning to get better at understanding ourselves looking outwards. And you see it in our preoccupation with borders and border security and the notion that we're an island and we have an enormous littoral zone, and unless we keep a very, very close eye on it, all sorts of terrible things will happen. I think that a failure to understand our coasts and to think in that outward-looking sense has made us quite myopic about our place in the world. If you apply some thought to coastlines and the way they've informed our history, I think you get a much better rounded view of Australian history, that the looking inwards has really done us a disservice.
Jock, coming towards the end of our discussion now, we wanted to ask you a question that we ask all our guests here at Archives Anonymous, as that would suggest it's a sort of confessional moment, but don't worry, it's a safe space. Have you got a dirty little archive secret that you would like to share with us?
I think Google Earth is probably the biggest of my dirty little archive secrets. So many descriptions of landscapes and coasts that I've used have come from me sitting at a computer screen, not doing the hard work, doing the easy work, just panning over the land and going, ah, there's a boulder. Okay, I'll put the boulder in. And now I'll describe it by dropping down to street level and we can see how high the boulder is. And none of that is particularly strenuous work. I think that's cheating.
So you tricked us into thinking you walked 700 kilometres up the coastline, really you were just sitting in the comfort of your own home on the computer.
Yeah. Or the terrible practice of just snapping photographs out a car window as you go past something.
I think all of us trove addicts can relate to that one. Instead of the hours that it used to take people to actually turn over the crusty pages of newspapers, we're now just actually sitting at our desks.
I wish I had a white glove act, but I just don't have a white glove act at all.
I think we might have a subtitle or an alternative title for our podcast. We could call this The White Glove Act.
I love it.
Well, thank you so much for joining us here today, Jock. It's been a fantastic conversation.
Thanks.
To learn more about Jock's work, you can look at his page on the Text Publishing website or follow him on Twitter at Jock Sarong. So until next time, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on Wurundjeri land. Wurundjeri sovereignty was never ceded, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
You can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian. Coming up on the next...
We always do that. Okay. You go.
Coming up on the next episode...
It never stops being this incredibly exhilarating experience. I find it exhilarating because you are uncovering with every scrape of the trowel, you're scraping away, especially at those lower levels. Sometimes... couple of hundred years with every scrape of the trowel, what emerges is a history. An archaeological site is not a monument. It is a history that is recovered through sweat, science, and imagination.